Well, welcome to the show. One of my favorite books, and one of the great books ever written, is A River Runs Through It. I've quoted it on this show a number of times. I've reread it almost about every 2 years. And I want to tell you about a new book that is out by John N. McLean called Home Waters. One of the things that if you remember the movie and if you remember the book, you'll remember that the Reverend McLean, remember him? One of his lessons, of millions of lessons that he gave, was do something great. John McLean has written a number of books. He was a great correspondent in Washington for the Chicago Tribune for 30 years. He would not like the Tribune now, but he has come up. John, I got to tell you something.
Tell me, Rick.
I would have read this book no matter what. I would have read this book if it was written in crayon. I was blown away by this because I also understand the challenge in taking on your family, because your family, thanks to your dad, who was one of my father's best friends, your family was made famous by your dad's book. And, this has been called, this is not a memoir, ladies and gentlemen, at least I don't refer to it as a memoir. Some reviewers have called it a companion to A River Runs Through It. What do you consider this book, John, as difficult, and I think it was, as difficult as it may have been to write for you? What do you consider this book? How would you classify it?
Well, it started as a fish story.
Don't they all?
And it got spun longer and longer from there. I call it a chronicle in the end, and I had a discussion with my editor about that. That's the subtitle, A Chronicle of Family and a River.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, why don't we call it a memoir? That's a genre, and everybody understands what that is. And I said, well, because it's not. It's not about all about me. There's some of me in there. But it goes back. It starts in 1806 with the Lewis journey through the Blackfoot Valley in Montana.
Lewis being Lewis Meriwether Lewis by himself. He had already split up with Clark. I found that. I also got to tell you something, John McLean. I fished once somewhere in Michigan, caught a fish, tried to take it off the hook. It died in my hands, and I never fished again. I was so...
You felt bad.
I felt terrible, obviously. It's a lot of years to not fish. Every part of this book, from the history of it to the... It is not a technical fly fishing book, but it captivates me. It captivated me. That's much to your credit. I mean, what else can I say? So it started as a fish story. Who decided? It wasn't you, but it was someone else who said, someone who went to Montana, read the fish story, as I'll refer to it, in a magazine, and said, wow, maybe there's a book in this, right?
Right. And that was became my editor at HarperCollins, Peter Hubbard, very fine guy. And what I discovered once we started talking about it as a book was that I had a big scrapbook, let's call it, of things that I had written over the last several decades, 3 or 4 decades, that wound up being regurgitated in one form or another in the book. Not all of them worked, not all of them made it. But I had looked into these issues of family for a long time, in particular about my Uncle Paul.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because he was a shadow person in my life from beginning to the present day. And I got into the newspaper business like Paul. I'm a fisherman like Paul. There were some other similarities, some of them fortunate, some of them not.
Or particularly.
I learned a lot of lessons from Paul, and some of them were negative lessons.
Yeah.
Don't be like this. Anyway, it turned out I had an awful lot of stuff, and I started writing it and having fun with it. And I never thought of it as a backstory to A River Runs Through It, but I realized that I was getting into the same people and some of the same events, that I was going to have to explain some things, like a connection to the book of A River Runs Through It.
Sure.
And I described that the first time my wife, Frances, and I read the typescript of that.
I'm going to read. I love this book so much. You're going to be on for an entire hour. There are a number of... you know, if I had my druthers and commercial radio were a different beast, I'd just sit here and read the whole book to everybody listening. But I can't do that. I'm going to read some excerpts from it. It is. You're proud of this book, aren't you, John?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah.
I've had a little learning experience with since it came out. When I was finishing it up the final year, I was also working on another book, which is still pending. And when I got to the end of Home Waters, I was utterly exhausted.
I'll bet.
I didn't look at it and say, oh, my gosh, I've written a companion book to A River on Shore. I said, God almighty, I'm glad I got this thing done.
I'm glad these people are out of my way.
People have reacted to it in much the same way.
Yeah.
And I keep hearing the same things, and it's not what I expected to hear.
Well, but I'll tell you something.
I wasn't prepared to hear that.
Well,
this is my sixth book.
I know.
A lot of other books.
Fires.
That's what I've written about are fatal wildland fires where very fine young people, in many cases, are burned to death. So people don't rush up to me and say, I loved your book. I think
Of course not. Of course not.
And they do with this. And I'm not bragging, I hope.
No, I know. I know you're not. I've read
reviews.
That's
actually what people say.
Literally, most people.
I've had a hard time with this.
I'll bet. All right,
evolution.
I'll go easy on.
I'm starting to wake on it.
I'll go easy on the praise then, John. We got to take a little break, but John McClain's going to be here for the rest of this hour, talking about the majesty that is his latest book, Home Waters, A Chronicle of Family and a River, that river being the Blackfoot River. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I am on the phone from Washington with my old friend and colleague, John McClain, from the Chicago Tribune in the day, when it was a vastly different paper than it is now. I have to ask you one thing, John. In the book, in your new book, Home Waters, which is a chronicle of your family and a river, you write, fishermen know the wonder of being attached to a living but unseen power that lies below the surface. The connection between my family, the Blackfoot River, and Montana has been like that, a tie rooted in memory and rekindled each year. You used to, as a young child, would drive out. Your father was, for many, many years, decades, a esteemed professor at the University of Chicago. You drive out there. You make the trip so exciting. Did it ever – does it bother you now? Are you going out there this June?
I am.
Are you? Who do you go with?
I go alone because I work so much when I'm there that it's much easier for me – and more appropriate for me to go on my own.
It's certainly a much longer drive than it would have been from Chicago. Do you still drive?
I've done it, but it is an awfully long drive. And I've done it in 3.5 days, which was brutal. And I've done it in a week or 8 days. Most of the time, they have very good air service out there now.
When you were
this year was trying
yeah,
to get
exactly, yeah, exactly. When you were in the process of writing the book, I know you probably did a lot of research out there too, and you had to do some research. It doesn't all come back fresh and floating. What was that like? Rekindling those memories, not to use a fire sort of analogy, must have set some of them really ablaze in your mind. Is that a too romantic a notion?
It was like reading a book that you read when you were a kid and had mostly forgotten about. And as you turn the pages and get into it, things start coming back, and then you start anticipating with pleasure what's coming back and looking forward to the next chapter. That was part of it, but it wasn't all of it, because I did some new things in this too.
And sure.
We talked about the Meriwether Lewis journey through the Blackfoot Valley in 1806. It was on the return journey. He and Clark had split up at Traveler's Rest in the Bitterroot Valley, and then they split up, both of them, again, and have been criticized for it ever since.
Sure.
But they were still trying to find that Northwest Passage, and not much happened in the Blackfoot Valley that has been picked up by historians. But for the Blackfoot Valley, it was very important because it was the beginning of the end of the river of the Road to the Buffalo, which is the long time route that the Native Americans took out to the Buffalo grounds along the Missouri River on the plains. The Western tribes would go out and back twice a year, usually.
Mm-hmm.
They subsisted on the buffalo. And so I'd always known about it and read the journals and whatnot. But once I started getting into that, that was all, I got a lot of new stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's fascinating.
An historian in Seeley Lake, our little town, who knew all about it and who had found places where that road, the old Indian trail, still exist and are not well known. There are a couple of spots where there are rock cairns that are well known, but he had found places where you can actually see the trail. They're off the beaten path.
Sure.
But,
yeah, you can say.
They fit. And so at the end of this exercise, which went on for quite time, and you know, it's a long trip, and when you're getting out to look at things and spending a day at one place, it takes a long time to do it. But at the end of that, I had a view of the Blackfoot Valley that I'd never had before.
Yeah.
So I always stayed down on the river.
Yeah.
So you're up on the mountains, and you can see the whole thing, and it was revelatory. So I had two kinds of experiences. One was kind of turning the pages of a familiar book and rediscovering things from childhood and working them up again. And the other was a lot of new stuff came along, and that was made it really fun.
Well, much of it, I mean, much of the stuff that, you know, as you people who read the book and more precisely remember the movie, you remember that Brad Pitt, as Paul McLean, was killed, and that's kind of that he always was kind of a, I don't know, you're right here too, John, and forgive me for keep reading your lovely prose, but that's who I am. If Paul's story had ended there, it would have remained a shocking family tragedy best left in the past. It did not. The portrait Norman managed to create in A River Runs Through It gave Paul a lasting afterlife as the charming rebel, doomed but beautiful and gifted with a fly rod. He was forever the younger brother. This is one of the most haunting parts of the book. You write that many years later, and you were obviously watching this, your father would come down from the cabin to the lake in the evening when the world had turned to gentleness, and I would sit on the bank watching for a fish to rise. Without acknowledging my presence, but knowing I was there, he would call out, "Paul! Paul!" His face nearly incandescent with the light of remembrance and expectation. That is some of the best writing, and it will haunt me for a long time, as I suppose it haunted your father his whole life. Yes?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was an adult when that happened.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, you know, he never let it go.
Yeah.
I think what I would add to that is that, you know, he Paul was killed in Chicago. He wasn't killed in
Montana. Yeah, he wasn't killed. Right.
I kind of tried to find a meaning or romanticize, I don't know, but to find something in his death that was not just being beaten to death in a dark alley in Chicago as a way of coming to terms with it. And I think he failed. I think that what he succeeded in magnificently was giving Paul an afterlife, which continues to this day. And I know this because my dad got a lot of letters like this. They would come in from people who had a sibling, could be a sister as well as a brother, who was wayward. And they had tried to give something of themselves to their sibling to help them out, and they'd failed. And suddenly they found that there was compassion and understanding for that. On a very eloquent level.
Yeah.
And it, you know, this grief never goes away.
Of course
but
not.
It can evolve. And it seems to me that that is Paul's real legacy, that he is helping a lot of people who are in that position.
Boy, that's a lovely, lovely, lovely thought, too. You really do give his last day a thorough, you know, even though where he went to went to dinner. He took his girlfriend to dinner at the famous old Morton's on 55th yep. Street in Lake Park Avenue in Hyde Park after going to see the White Sox play a game. And here's another nice thing about Paul. You capture him here, too, which, you know, and I think of him, sadly, as, you know, Brad Pitt. I mean, what am I supposed to think of him as? I see there are photos in the book.
So does everybody else.
You're not kidding, man. You're not kidding. For a time, you know, there's so many interesting things here. You know, I did not know, for instance, that your father at one point tried to get a job at the City News Bureau, but the guy tried.
Paul did.
Yeah, the Paul did, but your dad's friend at the UFC didn't have sufficient clout at the time, but that later you and your wife and one of your kids all worked for City News. And I love the way you treat that, too, when he did have some clout. Your dad also toyed with being a reporter, did he not?
No, he never did.
Never.
He was contemptuous of journalism until he had to do it himself. And then suddenly all that changed. And when he was doing Young Men on Fire, he would look at me and say, why, this is journalism. Yes, Dad, this is reported. This is what you're doing.
Well, I'm surprised he liked
it. No, he thought that journalism was something for stevedores and bricklayers. But in the end, he realized that we stevedores and bricklayers build
serves.
Big, strong walls.
We serve or used to serve some kind of purpose. You write, I'll end this section of the interview by writing about one of your father's, and my father adored your father and respected him tremendously.
They were very good friends.
You write in here about one of his first duties when he came to the UFC. One of his first duties was grading freshman English papers, reams and reams of them. He described the routine as, quote, going home late Friday afternoon, having a couple of shots of Prohibition gin, going to bed right after dinner and reading 30 1,000-word compositions on subjects as irrelevant as how to fill a silo, which he joked sourly had made him an expert on corn. That's one of the great insights into Norman McLean when he was in Chicago. We'll continue on. We got John McLean on here. We'll talk about the Paul story after the news. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Roger Badish with the news. The recently published Home Waters, A Chronicle of Family and a River, is a brilliant, compelling, fascinating, incredibly engaging look at the family of John McLean, his sister, his dad, Norman McLean. Here's him capturing in a charming little section an anecdote. John is on the phone. He's not listening to me read. Once back in teaching English, he did not hesitate to introduce his students, urbanites to the core, to the joy of fishing and an outdoor life. When Jean and I, Jean being John's sister, and I were in our early teens, he once invited us to a class he was teaching on the story of a big fish, Ernest Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea. He asked his students at one point about the technical problem Hemingway faced in trying to tell a book-length story with only one human figure, the Cuban fisherman Santiago, who hooks a giant marlin. Who, besides Santiago, could play the role of a main character and provide the conflict necessary to move the story along, he asked. I thought it was the easiest question I'd ever heard in a classroom, but it stunned the students into silence. After a pause of embarrassing length, I raised my hand and my father called on me. The fish, I said. My dad took a beat, smiled a beatific smile, and said, that's my son. That is one of the most charming stories I've ever encountered. John, how often did you go to class? It couldn't have been often with your dad. And
I think that was the only time.
Really? Wow.
Because it was a fish story.
Yeah.
Gene, attended the university all the way through.
Sure.
Including law school, and was on his Committee on General Studies in the Humanities. So she went, I'm sure, often. But that was my one shot. Not a bad one.
No, I mean, my God, talk about memorable. Did you have a sense growing up what an esteemed teacher he was? Because that is absolutely true. My father called him perhaps the best teacher that has ever taught at the University of Chicago, my father being a U of C guy during the Depression. Did you know?
I don't think we realized how big a deal it was. For one thing, the University of Chicago is a science organization and a research school.
Sure.
And my father was neither a scientist nor a researcher. They are, you know, devoted to scholarship. And as he used to say, that the professors would get out of the college teaching into the graduate school as soon as they possibly could to get away from the students and do their scholarly work. And he was the opposite.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He was successful as a teacher at an institution where teaching was not the highest good. And so that was one of the things that we saw. You felt that. I mean, you knew that. That he was well-regarded among his colleagues, mm-hmm. and yes. That,
the family was driving out to Montana every June, late June, because it can still be nasty, as you say, in early June in Montana. Did you get a sense of him changing, of his mood being freer, of his...
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
To be back
there was enough time to make the transition. It was a long trip. We didn't hurry. You know, 300, 350 miles a day was a mm-hmm. big day. And we would spend a week, 10 days, in Wolf Creek before we ever got up to Seeley Lake. So by the time we got to Seeley Lake, he was a very different person. And, you know, he wasn't uptight the way you are when you're working all the time.
Yeah,
And he loved the life out there and working on the wood pile, fishing, working on the cabin, working with his hands. He was very good at that and liked it. And that's kind of the opposite of, you know, working with your head all the time and
sure,
your mouth.
Sure, yeah. Sure. When there must have been something. To see him fish, and you did, you say in here that he didn't teach you how to fish, but you learned from a kind of osmosis and just by observing him. When you watched him fish, how did you feel? That's a pretty broad question.
Well, I felt wonderful. Fishing with my father was one of the things that I have loved most in my life.
Yeah.
He was not an easy man, and he could be real rough on you if you screwed up. So it was not like, you know, some little rose-colored joy time.
Sure.
But he made it important, Rick. You know, I talk about that in the book. You know, you can be walking along thinking you're catching fish and kicking stones in a river and just, you know, having yourself a nice sloppy day. And the next thing you know, you're into something really profound.
Yeah.
Because he stopped. He would do this a lot. He would stop and start to look around and gather himself. And then he would start to speak about something that had struck him, that he saw or had experienced. And it was like a guy in front of a class sometimes, and it could drive you crazy.
I'm sure.
Be very frustrated. Why aren't we just moving on to the next hole and, you know, catching another fish? But in retrospect, and frankly at the time, you know, he brought more to the game than anyone else.
Well, I think, John, that is one of the currents, if I can use another sort of fishing water analogy, that runs through a river, runs through it. I mean, his feelings and understanding of that river and fishing are profound, and they come through, I think, in that book. And I'm not just talking about the famous first paragraph or that glorious, insanely beautiful last paragraph of the book. This book is also filled with characters too, and filled also. I'd be lax not to mention the these stunning wood engravings by an artist named Wesley W. Bates. Whose idea was that? And this guy, it so enlivens and enriches the book.
Well, let's be modest and say it was my dad's idea.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I discussed with my editor, and that I had no resistance to it, I said, well, why don't we have wood engravings in Home Waters just like they are in the first edition of A River Runs Through It? I love that first edition.
Oh, me too.
My dad did, too. He called it the Little Blue Book. He was in on the design of it. And by chance, before I ever started to write this book, I had helped a guy who was doing a piece, an essay on the illustrations of A River Runs Through It, find the guy who had done all the illustrations, all the wood engravings on the cover of A River Runs Through It about 40 years earlier.
Wow.
He's still living in Hyde Park, got a name of Robert Williams, and he was able to answer for us a lot of questions, such as, what is the cover representative of? First edition has a wood engraving with a cliff and a river running below it. And people say, well, where is that in Montana? Is that on the Blackfoot? Is that on the Missouri? Where is that? Or is it in Wyoming? And Robert Williams said, it's nowhere. It came out of his imagination. Dad gave him a lot of images and illustrations, and he took off from those and made his own. And so, fine. Wow. So then we get to doing Home Waters. And I said to my editor, I said, why don't we do the same thing? So he found this guy, Wesley Bates, a Canadian. And we decided to have one on each section.
Yeah.
There are a lot of them in there.
Yeah.
And they are very unlike A River Runs Through It.
Right.
These are closely tied to the text.
Yep.
They illustrate the text. And we worked with Wesley, and he worked with us. He's a wonderful guy. He got it. Right away. You didn't have to explain mountain right. lakes to him where the trees come right down to the shoreline. He knew it all, and he did a great job. And we passed those among the three of us back and forth, and he worked them up, and you have that.
It's a real bonus to the book, John. I'll tell you that right now, a real bonus.
I'm glad you feel that way.
I do. I think they're beautiful, too. They're just beautiful. We got to take one last break, commercial radio being commercial radio, and I want to come back and talk about this other intersection of the lives of the McLeans and the Cogans. We'll be right back. Here's John McLean writing in his fantastic book, Home Waters. Whether you fish, whether you've ever been, you know, west of Halsted Street, it doesn't matter. This book is, there's a universality to this book. It doesn't matter what kind of life you've led, you will find something in here to love. Here he writes, the Pulitzer Prize jury for fiction in 1976 was chaired by Herman Cogan, book editor of the Chicago Sun-Times. Cogan's jury put A River Runs Through It at the top of their recommendation list. My father wrote in a letter, its qualities are copious. The range of emotions and insights is broad and compelling, and its concern with life in all its aspects has, despite the narrative's specific time and place, a sense of the universal. There was no prize awarded that year, and my father was understandably outraged, and we later learned that one of the people who put the kibosh on it was Clayton Kirkpatrick, who was then the editor of the Chicago Tribune, and then John McLean's boss. That whole story, I remember when you wrote that, John, and based on a Mike Miner of the Reader had come up with the notion of perhaps awarding a prize retroactively.
Yes.
It would have been a great thing for your dad, but the book did change his life. You write here, this book is so good, John McLean. Success is, my dad, as can be guessed, was absolutely delighted with your letter to Clayton Kirkpatrick. Success is welcome to any age, but A River came out the year my father turned 74 years old, and it exalted him and propelled him forward as a writer and as a public personality. He seemed bigger physically, walking with a strut and speaking in a voice of renewed authority. That must have been a wonder to behold.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was transformational.
And he was working. How did it change his and your and the family's life in Montana? Was he viewed as a massive celebrity out there?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I bet.
Suddenly Montana was filled with thousands of people who wanted to go fishing with Norman McLean.
Where's that Norman McLean? Where's that McLean guy? How would you, it doesn't really get into it, the movie was made, Redford bought the movie, Redford narrates the movie, and it came out in 1992, which is 2 years after your father died. What did you think of the movie, John?
I like it, which I guess I'm not supposed to. A lot of my fishing friends say, well, you know, it's not the book.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's not the book.
No, but it's not.
There are some things about it that I find both admirable as well as likable. The main one is that it's a family movie.
Yeah.
A whole family can go see this.
That's right.
Including kids.
That's right.
And there's plenty of content for adults, and the kids all like Brad Pitt and Paul.
Yeah.
And I've talked to them about it, families, and they say, well, kids know that his kind of behavior is not sustainable and that something is going to happen bad. When it does, they don't have to see it.
Yeah.
The violence is off-screen.
That's a good, boy, that's a really good point. And it wasn't just because of the details of the of what had befallen.
No, Redford sustained that. I mean, it's the same in the book.
Yeah.
But he kept that and respected it. I think he did a wonderful job. You know, a movie isn't the book. Ever.
No, of course not.
And as I say, you know, I hear a lot of, well, it wasn't the book, and it wasn't perfect. It was,
yeah.
Well, it was pretty darn good. And I will tell you something. Here we are, what, 29 years later or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And it is still a very popular movie. It is beloved by people. And it is still, I'll tell you, earning royalties.
I'll bet. And the book has still got to be selling, not like crazy, perhaps, but healthy numbers.
Steadily because it's in schools.
Yeah.
Well, and it has, you know, it has a following beyond that. But it is in literature classes. It's a, what do you have for American literature?
Yeah.
it is a staple of American literature and of English literature.
I can't tell you how often I've read that beginning and last chapter on this show. I think, apropos of nothing but the fact that I just reread the book. Don't want to end on a down note, but how's the river? I mean, it did, after the book was published, get a real influx of, you know, people who just, you know, spent $2,000 at Orvis and didn't know how to fly fish, going out there to, you know, bask in the light of a river runs through it. How is the river?
Well, it is the celebrity of the river has been a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. It was really, really in bad shape about the time the 70s and 80s. The Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks had stopped doing fish counts there because it just wasn't worth it. There was a dam at its headwaters that had mine tailings in it that had collapsed, and the river was full of cadmium. For years, a couple of years, we didn't fish it at all because the fish were poisoned. And it was just in really sad shape. Before the movie came out, Trout Unlimited had started to make a move to try to help it. But they, you know, don't have vast resources, and they have a lot of other priorities. Once the movie came out, there was an awful lot of money available from a lot of different sources, and it was properly channeled through the Blackfoot chapter of Trout Unlimited and a group called Blackfoot Challenge. And they worked very closely with local people, and that was the magic that did it.
That's the key, of course.
You know, go to a rancher and say, you've got a tributary, and, you know, just running straight through, and it's shallow. Can we work on the tributary? You know, we'll pay for it and meander it and maybe put some fencing around to keep your cattle off the main river so they don't use it as a sewer. And we'll find a place for them where they can drink and so on. So the rancher would, you know, stroke his chin, think a little while, and say, oh, all right, you can go ahead.
Well, I hope
when
this
they were
book,
doing
I mean,
it, he would see that it was local people.
Sure. Well,
and
I hope
they were
this
not in uniform of some out-of-state corporation. And he'd say, well, you know, you could probably use some more railings right over there, and I got a couple behind the barn. And he would join
That's
the
great.
Party. That's a metaphor, but that kind of thing actually happened. The river has come back wonderfully.
I am very
grossly overused.
Yeah, I'll bet.
As the head of TU in Montana, a friend of mine, David Brook, says, we are loving it to death.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to find the kind of experience that we had easily when I was a kid, which is serenity and peace and being alone
can,
on the road.
Well, you people can touch on that experience by picking up Home Waters, A Chronicle of Family and the River. John McClane, I've always admired you as a reporter. We didn't even talk about that career, but who cares about that career now as newspapers vanish? You take care of yourself, please.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate
your I will have a review interview in the Chicago Tribune for next Sunday. So read that too. Take care, John. Best to the family.